demons and evil spirits. We're pleased to have with us our brother Bernard Burt, who will give us that address. And this is the first of two addresses, he tells me.
Good evening, brethren and sisters. There is one thing I think that we will all agree on to start off with before we begin to look at this subject, and that is that the subject is a difficult one. It's not a subject that can be dealt with in 5 minutes, and having studied it a little bit, I've come to the conclusion you can't really deal with it in 50 minutes either. So I was faced with three alternatives, basically. First, to do what I think we've all heard done, and that is to skim the surface of the subject, touch on one or two passages, and leave a lot of problems unanswered. Second would be to establish the scripture principles on which we can study the difficult passages which are involved in this subject, and then leave those difficult passages untouched. And I don't think we'd be very satisfied with that either. And the third is what has been arranged, to spread the subject over 2 evenings. I hope you don't now feel that you've come here under false pretences, because we're not going to get into the Gospels tonight. The arrangement was only made on Tuesday evening, which was why it wasn't announced on Sunday. So tonight I want us to think about the problem or the subject of demons and evil spirits in the Old Testament, and then the second address, the date of which hasn't been fixed yet, but it will probably be sometime in June or July, God willing, we will look at the passages in the New Testament. Having said that, this subject of demons and evil spirits can't be completely divorced from the subject of the devil and Satan. So I want to just look very, very briefly at the Old Testament teaching on the subject of the devil and Satan. Old Testament teaching on the subject of the devil can be dismissed in one sentence. The word devil, singular, does not occur in the Old Testament. And that's it. The word Satan, however, does on 33 occasions in the Hebrew text. It's translated once as resist, once as withstand, 12 times as adversary, and on the other 19 occasions it appears in our English text as the word Satan, the Hebrew word lifted out of the original script and transliterated into English. Can we look at the first occurrence of this word in the Hebrew text, which is in Numbers chapter 22. Now that of itself is very interesting, and if we are during this year of witness in discussion with someone who believes in the devil and Satan, then the first point which they may not be aware of is that the word devil does not occur in the Old Testament. The second point they may not be aware of is that the word Satan does not occur before the 22nd chapter of Numbers, which of course means that it doesn't occur in the book of Genesis at all. And there is no suggestion whatsoever that the serpent was motivated by any power of evil such as many around us believe in. But this first occurrence of the word Satan in Numbers 22 is a very interesting and very useful one, because here we are with Balaam, who is going on his way to see Balak in contradiction to God's express instructions. And we read in verse 22 of Numbers 22, "And God's anger was kindled because Balaam went, and the angel of the Lord stood in the way for a Satan against him." And that is the first occurrence of the word. And the Satan is quite clearly an angel of the Lord, not an evil being of any kind, but an angel sent by God to prevent Balaam from going on his way until he had learnt what God would have him know. Now the second occurrence of the word is also in this chapter, and it's in verse 32. "And the angel of the Lord said unto Balaam, Wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these 3 times? Behold, I went out to Satan thee, because thy way is perverse before me." Your margin will probably have the rendering, "to be an adversary unto thee." And that, of course, is basically what the word means. to be an adversary. And the adversary can be good, as in this instance, for Balaam's prophet, or it can be bad. I don't want us to look up any more passages on this subject, because we want to look at demons and evil spirits tonight. But if you want to jot down one or two further passages, which I think are very helpful, can I suggest the first of them to be the first book of Samuel, chapter 29 and verse 4. We know the context of that because we've read chapter 28 tonight. It's David going forth to fight, or wanting to go forth to fight, against the Philistines, and the lords of the Philistines said, no, he will be a Satan unto us, an adversary. So there it is, David who is the Satan. 1 of Kings chapter 5 verse 4 is another very useful passage, because that explicitly states that there was no Satan in the time of Solomon. That's a problem for those who believe in the devil. Where was he? 1 of Kings 5 verse 4. 1 of Kings chapter 11 verses 14 and 23. Now there we have two verses which tell us that the Lord raised up two men to be Satans, or adversaries, to Solomon in the latter part of his reign, when Solomon had departed from the Lord. And two final passages which want to be taken together. The second book of Samuel, chapter 24, verse 1. 2 Samuel 24, verse 1. And 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. If you compare those passages carefully, you will see there that the Satan is none other than the Lord God himself. And that's a very difficult problem to be resolved by those who believe that Satan is a supernatural power of evil. So to sum this up then, the Old Testament does not contain the word devil in the singular. The word Satan occurs on a number of times. There are many Satans, or adversaries. Some are good, some are bad. Some are human, some are divine, angels or even the Lord himself. Now we come to the word devils. The word devils occurs, and again this may surprise our friends to know it, only four times in the Old Testament. Twice it is a translation of one Hebrew word, and twice it is a translation of another Hebrew word. And we're going to look now at all four passages. The first word is the word Sair, spelt S-A-I-R. This word occurs 59 times in the Old Testament. 24 times it is translated as goat, 28 times as kid, and twice as devils, plus a number of other sundry translations. So we see that the basic meaning of the word is a goat or a kid. And in the 16th chapter of the book of Leviticus, it is used there of the goats, which were taken to be the goat for the sin offering, and the other one was to be the scapegoat. Of course, there's a special word for scapegoat, but where it says that two goats were taken, that is this word, Sair, used in the great chapter in Leviticus concerning the Day of Atonement. Can we look together at chapter 17 of Leviticus? Because there we see the word in both its regular and its abnormal usage. Leviticus chapter 17 and verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, and unto all the children of Israel, and say unto them, this is the thing which the Lord hath commanded, saying, what man soever there be of the house of Israel that killeth an ox, or lamb, or goat, and there's the word, in the camp, or that killeth it without the camp, and bringeth it not unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, to offer an offering unto the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, blood shall be imputed unto that man. He hath shed blood. And that man shall be cut off from among his people. So here we see the word being used in the context of various offerings which could be made and the regulations concerning how those offerings were to be presented. Can we now go on to verse 6? And I'm going to read now from the Revised Version. And the priest shall sprinkle the blood upon the altar of the Lord at the door of the tent of meeting, and burn the fat for a sweet savour unto the Lord. And they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices unto the he-goats, after whom they go a-whoring. This shall be a statute forever unto them throughout their generations. Now you see that the Authorised Version there has devils, where the Revised Version renders he-goats. And it is this same word that we saw in chapter 3, which is translated there as a goat, which was used as an offering. Now that doesn't perhaps help us very much, but if we turn to the other passage where this word is translated devils, which is the second book of Chronicles and the 11th chapter, then I think it will become clear what is being spoken of. The second book of Chronicles, chapter 11, and here we find ourselves in the time of Rehoboam and Jeroboam, particularly when Jeroboam had instituted worship of golden calves in the northern kingdom. And we read in the 13th verse of 2 Chronicles 11 of one of the results of that activity. And the priests and the Levites that were in all Israel resorted to him out of their border. For the Levites left their suburbs and their possession and came to Judah and Jerusalem. For Jeroboam and his sons cast them off, that they should not execute the priest's office unto the Lord. And he appointed him priests for the high places, and for the he-goats, and for the calves which he had made. There again, the Authorised Version translates the word as devils, the Revised as he-goats. I think we can now see what it means, because the context is Jeroboam and his golden calves. And he appointed priests for the golden calves, and also for the he-goats, which he had made. So just as Jeroboam made images of calves, he also made images of goats, which he commanded the people to worship. And this is logical, because Jeroboam had come from Egypt. And in Egypt, the goat was extensively worshipped. And in the passage in Leviticus, the context of that is that Israel had just come out of Egypt. And we know that Israel made a golden calf at the first opportunity. And Israel had been corrupted by the Egyptian practice of worshipping goats and calves. And Jeroboam reintroduces this into the national worship. So this word means nothing more or nothing less than either a real live hairy goat, or it means an image of a goat, an idol, which the people worshipped. Now to the second word, the word shed, spelt as in our ordinary garden shed, S-H-E-D. Now this word only occurs twice in the Old Testament, and on both occasions it's translated devils. First one is in Deuteronomy chapter 32. And with a word like this, where we have no other alternative translations to guide us, we are forced to look at the context and determine from the context what the word means. But again, both passages are helpful in enabling us to find this out. Deuteronomy 32 is the song which God commanded Moses to teach to the children of Israel. A song which is also a prophecy of what Israel would do in subsequent years. It's couched, in some parts at least, in the past tense, the prophetic perfect, which is so familiar to us as we read the prophecies of the Bible, and which we will meet again later on in our study. Verse 16 of Deuteronomy 32, and again I'm going to use the Revised Version. They moved him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations provoked they him to anger. They sacrificed unto demons which were no god, to gods whom they knew not, to new gods that came up of late, whom your fathers dreaded not. Now that's fairly straightforward, I think. Demons in the Revised Version, devils in the Authorised. But these, I think, are fairly clearly the gods, the idols, whom Israel, God foresaw, would worship when they came into the land. If we turn now to Psalm 106, which is the other occurrence of the word, this will be made, I think, abundantly clear. And bear in mind, brethren and sisters, that when we've looked at this passage in Psalm 106, we have examined tonight every occurrence of the word devils in the Old Testament. There are no more. Psalm 106, and we can go straight in at verse 34, and once again, the Revised Version. It's speaking again of what, not this time what Israel would do, but what they hadn't done. They did not destroy the peoples, as the Lord commanded them, but mingled themselves with the nations, and learned their works, and they served their idols, which became a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto demons, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Well, there again, I think it's fairly clear what the word means. It simply means the idols of the land that Israel had gone a-whoring after and were worshipping. And particularly, it means those terrible idols, Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon, and Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, to whom the children of Israel sacrificed their own sons and daughters. These gods apparently were constructed with their hands open and extended, and inside the body of the metal god of fire was burning. And the Israelite took his own son or daughter and threw the child into that fire in the heart of the god. It almost makes us sick to think about it, doesn't it? How God's people could do a thing like that. We, of course, would never get involved in that sort of thing. Civilized countries would never do that sort of thing, would they? It has been observed, though, brethren and sisters, by a brother who is very much respected amongst us, that Molech is with us today. Only it is not called Molech. It is called legalized abortion. And 1 million children have perished, not in the fiery arms of a god, but in the clinical atmosphere of an operating theatre. And our civilised Christian nation doesn't bat an eyelid. It wants the law made even easier. At least some of them do. Come out from among them, says God, and be ye separate. Let's look at something else now. The familiar spirit. This word, the original word, the Hebrew word ob, occurs 17 times in the Old Testament. 16 times it's translated as familiar spirit, and once it's translated as bottle. Now that may sound rather strange, so let's have a look at the bottle passage first of all, shall we? Job chapter 32. This is the chapter in the book of Job which introduces us to the young man Elihu, that wonderful young man who had more sense than Job's three friends put together. And he had listened to all their words with mounting impatience, as young men do when their elders are talking, and he wanted to make his contribution, but he was a well-disciplined young man and he held his peace until they had finished. When they had finished, he was more than ready to speak. Verse 17 of Job 32. I said, I will answer also my part. I also will show mine opinion. For I am full of matter. The spirit within me constraineth me. Behold, my belly is as wine which hath no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles. And there is the word which, in the passage in Samuel which we read, and in other passages, is translated familiar spirit. What then is the connection between the belly of Elihu, which was ready to burst like a new bottle, and the familiar spirit? Well, I found two explanations of this. The first one, which I ought to say was the explanation of a commentator who believed that there are such things as demons and evil spirits about in the world today, his explanation was that the person became a sort of a hollow sheath, a container, a bottle in which the demon dwelt, like the genie in the bottle or the genie in the lamp. And when the thing spoke, it wasn't the person but the demon inside him. I think we know what to do with that piece of exposition. But to be more serious, the word itself, the basic meaning of the word, is to mumble or to make a hollow sounding noise. You perhaps see where the bottle idea comes in now. It makes a hollow ringing noise if you hit it, or even a leather bottle distended could produce a hollow sounding noise. But apparently this word is connected with ventriloquism, where the person is making his voice to appear to come not from his lips and his mouth but from somewhere else. Usually they have a sort of ventriloquist dummy on the knee, and they make the voice come from somewhere down here so that it looks as if the dummy is speaking and not the ventriloquist. So the idea is of a hollow or muffled sort of noise coming from an irregular place. And this comes out in one of the familiar spirit passages in Isaiah 29. Now this is a passage which I believe is used by the Mormon Church to substantiate their teaching that Joseph Smith received those golden plates with further revelation from God upon them. Isaiah 29, the prophecy concerning Ariel, Jerusalem, and the fourth verse. And thou shalt be brought down, and shalt speak out of the ground, and thy speech shall be low out of the dust, and thy voice shall be as of one that hath a familiar spirit, out of the ground, and thy speech shall whisper out of the dust. I haven't discussed this with them, but I believe the Mormons say that this means that God was to bring further revelation out of the earth, and this was when Joseph Smith found the plates. But I don't really think that they can substantiate it. But we do notice that the idea of a familiar spirit is connected with a voice from the ground, or a voice out of the dust, a voice from an irregular place. And of course these people who claim to have familiar spirits said they could communicate with departed spirits, communicate with the spirits of the dead. So the idea of voices from the ground or voices out of the dust, I think we can see how it fits in. But let's now turn to the book of Leviticus and see what God in his law has to say about those with familiar spirits. Two passages, Leviticus 19 and 20. Israel were going to go into a land where all sorts of magic, black and otherwise, existed, and God was warning them to keep well clear of all these things. Leviticus 19 and verse 31. Regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. 2 points. The first is that God says that if Israel went into that land and got involved with the people of the land who had or claimed to have familiar spirits, they would be defiled. Now that's a point to note, because there are all sorts of manifestations of this kind today, from the lady who sits in her tent in the seaside resort claiming to tell your fortune or read your palm, to the person who says they can tell what's going to happen to you tomorrow by looking at the tea leaves in the bottom of your cup, to the horoscope in the daily paper. And God said to Israel, if you get involved with these things, you will be defiled. And if we get involved in their present day manifestations, we too will be defiled by these things. Well, that was the case of Israel going into the land and people in the land who did these things. What happened if an Israelite himself or herself actually got involved and set up in business as one with a familiar spirit? Well, chapter 20 of Leviticus now, and verse 27. Last verse of chapter 20. A man also or woman that hath a familiar spirit, or that is a wizard, shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones, their blood shall be upon them. You see, God is absolutely uncompromising. Notice, by the way, that there is no question to be asked about the truth of this claim, whether this person has some marvellous power or not. That's not taken into question in either of the passages. Israel are just told they're not to get involved with the Canaanites, and if any of them do, then they are to be put to death. Now, it has been said that 95% of all these psychical phenomena and so forth can be explained on a rational and scientific basis. The other 5% can't be. There are things which we don't understand. There are powers of telepathy and sixth senses and so on that we don't fully comprehend. How identical twins can know what's happening to the other person, even though they're thousands of miles away, and have some sense or premonition that their twin has been involved in an accident. We just don't understand how these things work. And what God is saying is we're not to even try and investigate. We're just to keep completely clear of these things and not to get involved. We might ask why. I think the answer is found in the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 8. Here we have another of the passages where the word familiar spirit occurs. Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 19. Israel, of course, now are in the land, and all sorts of temptations come along. So God, through his prophet, warns them again. Verse 19 of Isaiah 8, and once again I'm going to use the Revised Version. And when they shall say unto you, seek unto them which have familiar spirits, and unto the wizards that chirp and that mutter. Here's these strange voices coming out again, you notice. Should not a people seek unto their God? On behalf of the living, should they seek unto the dead? To the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, surely there is no mourning for them. Now that is mourning as when the sun rises, not mourning for the dead, if you haven't got a Revised Version. And that too is very interesting. There is no mourning for them. They will not see the kingdom. It's like that New Testament passage in Ephesians where the apostle says, for this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. No one who gets involved in these things is going to have any part in God's eternal purpose. But why? Surely it's this. That these who claim to have familiar spirits and occult powers were setting themselves up as those who could foretell the future by whatever means, communication with dead spirits or whatever. And the first point that is made is, well, this is nonsense anyway, because you can't get information about the living from the dead. Reading the Revised Version of the end of verse 19. On behalf of the living, should they seek unto the dead? Of course not. The dead know not anything. The point is that these people who were claiming to do this were, by the very essence of what they were doing, setting themselves up as alternative sources of information in competition with the Almighty. And God will not have competition from any man. He is the revealer of secrets, the foreteller of the future. And it is to him and to his word we must seek if we want to be enlightened. And that, of course, was Saul's problem. Because he wanted to find out information from God, and God was not revealing it to him by any of the legitimate sources. And so, as we've read in that chapter in 1 Samuel 28, Saul tried to go to another source to obtain the information which he required. And here we come to that well-known passage of the witch of Endor, as she is called. Verse 6, as we see, Saul had attempted to find out from God what would happen by the, what we might call, the regular means, by dreams. No, he didn't have a dream about it. He went to the priest, consult by means of the Urim and Thummim, but however that method of communication worked, it was not operative at this time, nor was there any prophet who could tell him. So Saul desires now to find out from another source what he can't find from the legitimate methods. Verse 8. And Saul disguised himself and put on other raiment, and he went and two men with him. I think it was Brother Derek Clark who made the point quite some years ago now, how could a man who was head and shoulders above the rest of the people disguise himself? Wouldn't a woman see through it straight away? Well, there's that in it, but there's more in it as well, brethren and sisters. Have you ever looked at a map in connection with this chapter? Have you ever seen just where it was that the Philistines were encamped? And what a dreadful situation Saul was in. Because Shunem, where the Philistine camp is north of Mount Gilboa. The Philistines had gone right up the land, if this is the Jordan River here. Sorry, I'm reverse way round to you. That's the Jordan. The Philistines had come right up the land and were coming back down again almost. And Saul was south of them. That was the terrible state he was in. But it's even worse than that. Because if you look at the map, you'll see the relationship of Mount Gilboa and Shunem, where the Philistine camp was, and Endor, where this woman was. And you'll see, if you look, that to get to this woman from his camp, Saul had to pass through the camp of the Philistines, or at least just go around the edge of it. That's how desperate he was to get the information. He would even go through or beside the enemy camp to find out what was going to happen in this battle on the morrow. And he evidently believed that he was going to get the information. Of course, there are people who read horoscopes and believe that the stars guide them. However we care to look at it, whether there is anything in this familiar spirit or not, Saul believed that he could get some information from this woman. And so he went. And so in verse 11, she asked him the question, "Whom shall I bring up unto thee?" And he said, "Bring me up Samuel." So this woman starts with her incantation or whatever it was. And then verse 12, when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. Now that word cried literally means to shriek with anguish or out of danger. Something happened which this woman just had not been expecting. She was terrified. And she immediately, if she hadn't realized it before, realized that this is the king. Verse 13, and the king said unto her, "Be not afraid, for what sawest thou?" And the woman said unto Saul, revised version, "I saw a god ascending out of the earth." And he said unto her, "What form is he of?" And she said, "An old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle." And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. So there was something there which Saul recognized to be the form, the shape of Samuel. And Saul stooped with his face to the ground and bowed himself. And Samuel said to Saul, let's look now at verse 17. "The Lord hath done to him as he spake by me." Now this was the way that the prophet spoke. God has fulfilled that which he spoke through me. "For the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and given it to thy neighbour, even to David." Now here's the prophetic perfect again. He hadn't then. Saul was still the king. David was a fugitive way down in the land of the Philistines. But just as God had made Abraham the father of many nations before Isaac was born, so this was most surely appointed by God, and this had as good as happened. Why? because thou obeyedst not the voice of the Lord, nor executest his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee this day. Again, this was the way the prophet spoke. Because you have not hearkened unto the voice of God, therefore this has happened to you. And then verse 19. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. So it's a specific prophecy. And of course, if you read the succeeding chapters, it came true to the letter, exactly as it had been foretold. We can look again now at verse 15. Samuel said to Saul, "Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up?" And verse 19 again, "Tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me." The whole language of this chapter, of this section of the chapter, is as if Samuel was actually there, standing before Saul. I think if we consider this and the circumstances of verse 12, the straightforward conclusion to come to, and the explanation which I would give for this chapter, is that Saul went to this woman seeking information by an occult means, a means which may or may not have existed or been capable of providing information, and it probably didn't, but Saul thought it did. And then God took over. And God, as he did on other occasions, raised up one of his servants to deliver a specific message and a prophecy. And the woman was scared out of her wits when this happened, because she just had not expected anything like this. And it helps to explain a rather interesting phrase at the end of the 15th chapter of this same book. A rather puzzling little phrase there, in the last verse of chapter 15, where, following the incident about Amalek, which Samuel has referred to in the 28th chapter, we have this detail at the end of chapter 15, verse 35. "And Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death." Now you can read that three ways. You can read it as, "Samuel never again came to see Saul." In which case, why not say so? And why put in the phrase, "unto the day of his death"? It could mean that Samuel never came again to see Saul until the day that he, Samuel, died. Now, if that is so, or was so, there's no mention of it. There's no mention that Samuel got up off his deathbed on his dying day and went to see Saul with the last message. And it's slightly unreasonable when you think about it. But the other possibility is that it means that Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of Saul's death. And that fits, because it was the day of Saul's death. It was in the night, and the Hebrew day started at 6 in the evening. So it was the day of the battle when this event happened at Endor. It was literally, according to the Hebrew method of reckoning, the day of Saul's death. And I think that this helps to confirm the interpretation of 1 Samuel 28, which I've put forward, and also explain that enigmatical little section in the 15th chapter. But now, finally, can we look at two more passages, the two passages in the Old Testament which mention evil spirits. The first is Judges chapter 9. Now, the words here are in no way unusual or abnormal. The word evil is the normal Hebrew word, the word ra, which is translated frequently in the Old Testament as evil. And the word spirit is the usual word, the word ruach, which time and again is translated spirit in the Old Testament. So nothing unusual about the words. In Judges chapter 9, we come to see the account concerning Abimelech, the son of Gideon's concubine. And we're told in the 22nd verse about Abimelech reigning for 3 years over Israel. and then in the 23rd verse, that God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Notice, it was God who sent this evil spirit, not the devil. It was God who sent this evil spirit. And the result of this was that the alliance between Abimelech and the men of Shechem was broken. And that instead of being partners in crime, it was a case of thieves falling out, and eventually they destroyed each other. Now this passage isn't greatly helpful in explaining to us what the evil spirit was, or how it worked, or anything about it. It merely states that it was God who did it by means of an evil spirit, whatever that was. The other passage, which is probably much more familiar to us, is the case of Saul. 1 Samuel chapter 16. Saul, after the events of chapter 15, to which we've alluded, was rejected by God from being king. And Samuel goes and anoints David, the man after God's own heart. And we read of this in the 13th verse of 1 Samuel 16. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed David in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. The margin has terrified him, which as far as I can see is a fairly accurate rendering of the original word. An evil spirit from the Lord troubled or terrified him. And Saul's servant said unto him, Behold now, an evil spirit from God troubleth thee. You see, they had no problem with this at all. They didn't believe in the devil and these demons going around, which were his emissaries, as so many people do today. They said, This is an evil spirit from God. It's troubling you. And they prescribed the remedy. Let our Lord now command thy servants, which are before thee, to seek out a man who is a cunning player on an harp. And it shall come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well. Of course, we know that according to the providence of God, and workings which we cannot understand, the man whom they thought of was David. And David was brought before Saul. And then we have the detail in verse 23, that it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took an harp and played with his hand, so Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. So this was not a continuous thing. The evil spirit came and it went. It was something that happened at certain occasions. And we have another of those occasions in the 18th chapter. David had slain Goliath, and the women came out singing and dancing, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. In verse 8 of chapter 18, Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands, and what can he have more but the kingdom? So you see, Saul was in an antagonistic mood. He was in what we would probably say today, he was in a foul temper because of this. And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. And then verse 10, immediately after this, on the morrow, the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand as at other times. And there was a javelin in Saul's hand, and Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David, even to the wall with it. And David avoided out of his presence twice. And Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, and was departed from Saul. And there we learn two more details about this evil spirit. When this evil spirit came upon Saul, he prophesied. Now, this word is the usual Hebrew word which is used of prophecy. But there are certain grammatical differences in the occurrence of Hebrew verbs to do with tenses and various bits which are tacked on, which I don't fully understand and can't therefore explain to you. But what I have gained is this, that when this word is used in a certain way, it does not mean, or does not necessarily mean, a revelation from God, a foretelling or a forthtelling. And the word is used in that way here. Another occurrence of the Hebrew being expressed in the same way is in the incident of Elijah and the prophets of Baal, where it says that the prophets of Baal prophesy from morning till evening. Now obviously that doesn't mean that the prophets of Baal gave forth inspired revelations about the future. It means that the prophets of Baal jumped up and down and shouted abracadabra or whatever word they did use to try and invoke fire from heaven. And it didn't work. That's the construction of the Hebrew in this verse here. So it doesn't inherently mean that Saul was giving forth coherent revelations. The Revised Version has rave instead of prophecy. Now whether that is a completely accurate translation, and I'm not qualified to say. But this we can say, I think, that it doesn't necessarily mean that Saul spoke in revelations. It may be that Saul gave forth utterances of various kinds which he might have thought were prophecy, or which some might have taken to be prophecy, but really they weren't. And the other thing is, and here's another point that we might notice, that when this evil spirit came upon Saul, then, among other things, Saul became violent. He had, again, what we would call today homicidal tendencies, and he threw the javelin at David to smite him to the wall. But David, because the Lord was with him, avoided it and dodged, and it missed. And the purpose of God was not thwarted by Saul, but David eventually became the king. And there we've got to leave it for tonight. We haven't looked at, by any means, all of the passages in the Old Testament, and the passages in the New Testament we will have to come to on the further occasion. But just to very briefly sum up, what we have seen is this, that the word devil does not occur in the Old Testament at all. The word Satan simply means an adversary, which can be good or bad. The word devils occurs four times, and in every instance refers to the idols or gods of the land. The phrase familiar spirit has reference to those who claim to be able to foretell or to pronounce upon the future, but people whom God regarded as abominations in the camp of Israel and were to be removed from it and not consulted. And the only evil spirits which we read of in the Old Testament are sent directly by God to accomplish his purpose in the men to whom he sent them. There is no foundation whatsoever in the Old Testament for the idea of evil beings motivated by a supreme evil power going around and afflicting people. And it's on that basis that we must come to the other passages in the New Testament.